Session number 6612, Reel 4.
Colonel Four Walker, Reel 4. While you were conducting these internal security operations in the countryside, where were you actually living?
We were actually billeted in Arab houses in the village of Lida with one company in... we were in the village of Ramleh, and we had one company in the village of Lida.
And the men were living in the Arab houses?
The men were living in Arab houses from whom the inhabitants had been evacuated.
Where were the inhabitants evacuated to?
I honestly don't know. They were cleared out by the civil authority, by the British civil authorities, and I don't know where they went.
And what sort of measures were taken for the security of these villages?
Well, we were not expecting to be attacked in the villages, but of course we had alarm posts. But our main role was to supply columns to go out to deal with any unrest in the countryside. We had, I remember, one incident in Ramleh when a Jew motoring to Tel Aviv from Jerusalem, car broke down, and eventually the poor devil got shot up, and we had to go out and try and catch the Arabs that had shot him. Of course, we arrived too late, and he'd disappeared into the countryside. But otherwise, there were no incidents while we were in billets.
And presumably the soldiers were living off their standard rations in the usual way.
Yes, the soldiers were living off ordinary rations, the same sort of rations that we had in Alexandria or Aldershot, except that they were cooked on active service cookers and dished up in containers.
What could the soldiers do when they weren't actually on duty? Could they walk out anywhere? Or
no, conditions were insecure, and nobody could walk out away from the billets. And it was very boring for the soldiers, and they didn't like it at all, because there were really no means of amusement except reading or lying in the barrack rooms and listening to gramophones.
And what could the officers do?
Well, the officers, exactly the same. We were confined to the billets, and I remember when we were in Jerusalem, if I wanted to go from the billets down to where the orderly room was, I always had to carry a loaded revolver in my pocket. So really the officers suffered exactly the same restrictions as the guardsmen did.
And where did you live? Did you have a house as your officer's mess?
I lived in an Arab house, which was perfectly civilised. It had a bathroom and a lavatory, but not very comfortable because there was no furniture.
What had happened to the furniture? Had it been taken?
The furniture had been taken out by the owner, and I just had to sleep on the floor on my bedroll.
There was never any question of furniture being supplied to you?
No.
I have one last question. Why do you think it was that the nuns in the monastery in Jerusalem looked after the Arab wounded, who were presumably Muslim?
Well, the nuns in the convent, who were of all nationalities, French, British and Italian, were merely carrying out their Christian duty of succouring the sick. And because these wounded and sick were Muslims, made no difference whatsoever to their Christian duty. And they looked after the local inhabitants extremely well. They had a very good liaison with them, and still do, not only in succouring them when they're ill and sick, but in helping them when they're in distress, supplying food and that sort of thing. And it really made one quite proud of being a Christian to see the way in which these devoted sisters and monks looked after the local inhabitants, although they were of a different faith.
What happened to you after you left Palestine?
The battalion moved back to Mustafa Barracks in Alexandria and continued to carry out its peacetime garrison duties. And the officers and men took up the social life which they'd left behind when they went to Palestine the previous October. And although the atmosphere seemed as if war was approaching, it did not interfere with our social life and activities. And I remember one of the great occasions for the battalion, including myself, was for the King's birthday parade, which we in traditional fashion celebrated by a parade on the race course in Alexandria. Shortly after this, in the late summer, I personally was posted to take command of the Coldstream Companies at the Guards Depot at Caterham. And I was there when war broke out in September. I was naturally rather disappointed at not being with a service battalion, and I applied to regimental headquarters to go to a service battalion, all three of our battalions by that time being overseas in France. But I was told by the regimental lieutenant colonel that I must remain at the depot while the reserve officers and non-commissioned officers who were going to staff the depot during the war got settled in. So there I remained until my old commanding officer, who by that time was commanding the 7th Guards Brigade, asked for me to be posted to his brigade headquarters in France as staff captain. And in February 1940, I went from Caterham out to the 7th Guards Brigade, who were billeted round Roubaix and Tourcoing in northern France.
When you were actually at the depot at Caterham, presumably your main duty was to control the flow of reinforcements and reservists.
The Guards Depot was the place where young civilians were received and received their initial training to become guardsmen. They arrived from all parts of England, usually in a pretty rough state at that time, because nobody joined the army unless they were unemployed or in an uncongenial occupation. And we had them there for 12 weeks, in which time we had to teach them elementary training consisting of foot drill and musketry and general military behaviour. I personally didn't enjoy it very much, as it was rather a come down from active service in Palestine, and it was most of the training was in the hands of the non-commissioned officer drill instructors, and we spent our time in inculcating these young men into disciplined foot drill, which is the basis of a guardsman's training. And after they'd done 12 weeks with us, they went on to the training battalion, where they were taught tactics and further field training. But at the depot, they had practically no field training. It was all individual training in drill and musketry.
So you were really socialising them into the guard's way of life.
Right? Yeah.
What was your impression of these recruits who came to you? Were they, do you think, of a higher standard or a lower standard than the ones you normally got in peacetime?
Once the war started, we had an influx of extremely good, extremely keen, patriotic young men who wished to volunteer and join up. And they were very fine material and took to military training like ducks to water and were very good. Then after that, we had an influx of national servicemen who were, again, very good because they'd chosen the Brigade of Guards when they were joined up. And on the whole, the standard of our recruits was very high, rather different from the type of young man that we had when before war broke out and before national service came in.
So you were really very happy with them?
Oh, yes.
Did you have much crime or other disciplinary trouble?
Very little, indeed. The only time I had, we had, rather amusing, we had a fascist infiltrator who attacked me. I was sitting in the orderly room, a company office, one morning when a guardsman was marched in front of me and for being late, for returning from leave. And I gave this boy a talking to and gave him a very minor punishment, at which he lost his temper, gave the Nazi salute and shouted out, "Sieg Heil, Hail Hitler." Luckily for me, I was rather taken aback at this. Luckily for me, the depot police sergeant was in the orderly room at the time, and I shall never forget it. He was a great big burly Scots Guard sergeant, and he seized this young man, hugged him like a bear, and carried him out of the orderly room, kicking and screaming, and that was the last I heard of him. He was put in the guard room, and eventually the military intelligence people came down and interrogated him, and I was told afterwards he'd been infiltrated into the guards' depot to cause trouble.
But he hadn't succeeded?
He hadn't succeeded, no.
When you were called to go to the headquarters of the 7th Brigade, how did you travel there?
I received movement orders from the War Office, and I caught a train, the daily troop train from Waterloo, and travelled by train to Southampton docks, where I boarded a troop transport, which was a channel passenger steamer, which had been completely gutted of all furniture. And after a day's delay, because of an alert of mines, we set off for Cherbourg.
Did you travel on your own?
I travelled singly on my own, but there was, luckily for me, a draft of guardsmen reinforcements in the ship, to which my batman was attached. So when I arrived in France, I was to pick up my own batman, who was a great friend and to whom I was very attached, and he was able to look after me all through the campaign in France.
Once you got to Cherbourg, how did you travel up to the...
When I got to Cherbourg, I was horrified to see the French soldiers who met the boat to tie them up, They were the scruffiest individuals I'd ever seen, unshaven and filthy dirty. And this was a foretaste of what the French army was like. When I got to Cherbourg, I was met the military transport officer who told me that I would be quartered in a nunnery in the town, which was used as the staging camp, and that the next morning I was to go to the station and catch the troop train up to the BEF. I got dinner that night in the French officers' club and then went to my monastic staging camp. The next morning, carrying my own baggage, I went to the station, and my mind went back to the war of 1870, because the carriages which composed this troop train were of about the 1870 vintage. The French had knocked all the windows out and boarded them up with planks, and they were very antiquated indeed. And I found two or three other British officers who were going up the line, and we chose a compartment and put our bedrolls down, ready to spend the night on the floor of the carriage. Luckily, my batman, who was also on the train, who was a very ingenious chap, went and bought me, with my money, a bottle of whiskey from the NAFI, and he was able to get the engine driver to supply hot water for washing and shaving, and we had a candle which we stuck into a beer bottle, which was our only method of lighting, and it took us 3 days to go up the line through northern France to get to the railhead for the BEF, which was a station called Seclin, which is just outside Lille. I was met there by the staff captain that I was taking over from, who motored me to brigade headquarters just outside Roubaix.
You say you went into a French officers' club in Cherbourg. Did you have occasion to discuss the state of the war with any French officers?
Not at that stage, no. But I did have, as is noted in my tapes, occasion to discuss the state of the French army when I used to go for dinner in Lille to the only good restaurant there, which had as its clientele British and French officers. And I happened to meet at the same table a French medical officer who was attached to a French battalion who were in the 5th French Army holding the so-called line on the left of the BEF. And as the battalion medical officer in the French Army, as well as the British Army, is the real chap who has his finger on the state of morale in a regiment, this chap horrified me by, when I asked him what the state of his troops were, he said they were no good at all. He said they was quite convinced they wouldn't fight. They'd been hanging about in billets with nothing to do. No training exercises were being organized for them, and there was no entertainment, and they were being paid 2 sous a day, which was what was laid down for paying the French army conscripts then, which was worth in our money in those days about 2 pence. And the men were thoroughly fed up, full of communist agitation, and he was quite certain that they wouldn't fight. Foolishly, I never passed this information on, because I'd been brought up to greatly admire the French army, which had done so well in the First War, and having been attached to the French army, I knew they had entirely different methods than we did, and that their idea of discipline was entirely different from ours, and so I thought, well, things must be all right. Had I reported it, possibly people might have realized what a broken reed they were.
Now, you arrived at your headquarters as staff captain. What were your principal duties as staff captain?
The staff captain of a brigade in those days was in the principal administrative officer for the brigade, and I was responsible for things connected with discipline, like court martials, the allocation of leave vacancies, to oversee the distribution of rations, which was normally done automatically by the RASC, to see for the replacement of any weapons or ammunition, again, which was automatically done by the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. But if it broke down or wasn't satisfactory, I had to step in. In fact, all questions of administration were the duties of the staff captain, while the brigade major was responsible for all operational matters.
Did you find that this work kept you very busy?
It kept me fairly busy, but more or less ran automatically. There was a lot of paperwork, usually about not very important matters, such as ENSA concerts, allocation of leave vacancies to the various battalions, which of course was extremely important, and any administrative difficulties over the work on the position and liaison with the civilian authorities over billeting, etc. We were stationed outside Roubaix. We were occupying a defensive position which had been chosen by the French general staff, and the battalions were billeted as near as possible to the positions which they would occupy in case of attack. They were billeted in the little industrial villages between Lille and Tourcoing and outside Roubaix, and they each had a sector of the line to occupy and work on. We were, as it was called militarily, three battalions up in line and billeted in the nearest inhabited village to the position. Sorry.
How long was the sector you had to cover?
I would think that the sector that we had to cover, I cannot remember exactly, but it was pretty long and not very tactical, if you know what I mean from point of view of length.
Not very well defended.
No, the defences, as I've said in my tapes, were extremely rudimentary. They consisted of the River Marque, which was a very small brook, as it were, a tributary of the River Esco, which would not have stopped a motor lorry, let alone a German tank. But somebody in the French general staff had seen this river line on the map and had said that that would be where the extension of the Maginot Line would be established. And we were about 40 miles from the end of the Maginot Line, and all our fixed defences consisted of were a few French pillboxes, and we were meant to fill in the defensive position between these pillboxes. The French idea was that the pillboxes would be armed with anti-tank guns, which fired to the rear and would be able to take on the German tanks if they penetrated the position, and then placed their unarmoured behinds towards the anti-tank guns and would therefore be more vulnerable. We were to fill in the gaps which would be occupied by infantry between the pillboxes and to put up wire. The ground was so waterlogged and the water table was so high that it was impossible to dig trenches. The moment you stuck a spade into the ground, you struck water. And all we could do was to build breastworks, sandbagged breastworks, which the sandbags were filled with peat, which was the soil, and wouldn't have kept out any enemy missile at all, let alone shell fire. Occasionally we had a railway embankment running through the position and we honeycombed that, but again that would have been shelled to pieces. Altogether the position was extremely unsatisfactory from the military point of view.
Could you give a general assessment of the battalion's strengths and weaknesses as you found it in 1940?
Being a guardsman, I am extremely proud of the way that the three guards battalions behaved while we were doing this trying time of waiting in 1940. The morale of all the battalions was extremely high, and I think it's a great credit to our training that this remained so. There was practically no crime, and they put up with uncomfortable, boring conditions extremely well. And, of course, the proof of the pudding came in the eating, because when we actually did come into contact with the enemy, they fought extremely well, and our training had paid off. Now, you ask about